Te reo ererangi o te mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
Assalamu alaikum, kia ora, and welcome to In Transit, the series where we centre the many journeys of immigrant ethnic women navigating life in Aotearoa New Zealand, with me, your host Hafsa. In each episode, I sit down with women who share their journeys of settling in a new land, the challenges they have faced, and the resilience that carried them through. From cultural clashes to quiet triumphs, and from moments of doubt to deep appreciation. These are raw, honest, and hopeful conversations. Whether you're new to the country or simply curious, this is your space to listen, learn, and connect. Kia ora and welcome to another episode of this podcast. And today I've got another guest with me. So now over to my latest guest to introduce herself.
Kia ora. Hi. My name is Rachel Mukweza Tapera. I am a mother. I am a daughter. I am a sister. I am a sister-in-law. I am all of those things in one, depending on where I am at any given point. Yeah, I do have a background in nutrition and public health, and I'm currently working in the research space within academia, where my passions lie in, you know, Indigenous theories and methodologies, and quite a bit of ethnic migrant health.
So now I guess, you know, you've spoken about ethnic migrant health. Now I really want to know about your roots. So tell me about where you are, where your roots are from, and describe the first day that you came to New Zealand and what that felt like.
Nice. Thanks. I came to New Zealand twice. I always say this. Once in 2012 and again in 2019. So I think I'll just talk about the 2012 experience because that was the very first time I landed on this whenua. So yeah, I'm proudly Zimbabwean. I was born and raised in Zimbabwe and came to New Zealand to pursue my postgraduate study in 2012. So in terms of my roots, yes, I was born and raised in Zimbabwe, but my maternal grandfather comes from South Africa. My paternal grandmother comes from Malawi. My paternal grandfather also has roots in Mozambique. So in terms of where I come from or where my ancestral roots are, they are sort of scattered across the southern regions of Africa, though I was born in Zimbabwe and claim to be Zimbabwean by birth. So yeah, so those are my roots. And yes, coming to New Zealand was to pursue my master's degree, which was in public health at that point. I think it's, what do I remember the most when I did arrive? I arrived literally in the middle of the night, like just a few minutes after midnight. So it was really dark on a July night. So it was raining, it was cold. I arrived with my two sons. So my children were aged 4 years and nine, and the other one was 9 months at that time. It was a dark, cold, rainy night. The good thing was we did have a van waiting for us. So we just got picked and were taken to our place of residence. So yeah, my first experience, what I remember vividly was the dark night. The dark, cold night, and I'm saying to myself, where have I brought my children?
And arriving in New Zealand, and I know you said you've come here twice, so you've come here to do your postgraduate study first, and then you came back in 2019?
Yes, to do another postgraduate study. So that was to do, yeah, my PhD.
Right, yeah. Like, so how did the first experience prepare you for the second experience? Or did it prepare you for the second experience?
I think it really did. After my master's, I think because it was me being in a very new country, juggling postgraduate studies with, very young children, without, the family networks and all of those things. It was a very difficult time. Like I really felt that I think I really got burnt out. My supervisors kept saying, "Oh, you should come and do your PhD and all of those things." And for me, I'd say to myself, "If you find me in a university again, you ask me. I'm not doing this ever again." But I didn't tell them in the face, but that was in my heart. I just said to myself, "I've had enough." So I think after going back home and then working in different places and all of that, I think we came to a point where my husband and I had to sit down and really think about the future of our children. So we're really thinking, okay, economically things were not going well in our home country, and we're thinking what will happen to our children, especially in terms of their education, in terms of opportunities. And we were thinking, oh yeah, relocation would be a good thing, because even if we say, oh yeah, they could go and do have their, university studies or whatever after high school in a different country, that wouldn't be, sustainable for us. That wouldn't be something that would want, to send our children away, and we're not there with them. So we decided, okay, that was a good time for us to really think about going somewhere else. So we had options. New Zealand was one of them, because we knew we had been here before. So we're like, yeah, New Zealand is one of them. But also Canada was on the list. So when we started doing our processes for immigration and all of those things, New Zealand really did take long. So I already had my offer for study. I had all of my uni stuff approved, but then, immigration took long. So whilst that process was happening, we actually started the application to Canada, and it was moving really fast. Like, and it was way cheaper to go to Canada than to come to New Zealand. So we actually had sort of said, oh yeah, so I think we're going to Canada. So the moment our Canada papers are moving, that's when all of a sudden New Zealand then, came back to us, and we started then pushing that process. So yes, it did prepare us, because now we had an understanding of what the situation was like. Wasn't too sure about Canada because of the cold, but then we knew, of course, the winters in Auckland would be rainy and would be cold and would be muggy. But then at least it's something that we've experienced before, not the cold in Canada. So yes, the first visit did prepare us for the second visit, for the second trip. So even just knowing where we'd be going, where we're going to be looking for a house, the schools that would want the children to be in, all of those things were easier the second time around. So yeah, it did prepare us.
Oh, nice. So, you had a pretty good idea when by the time you were coming back around, how you wanted your children to be settled, and you started to think about all of those things. Yeah, all right. So I guess my next question is around so coming back to the first experience then. Let's talk about that first year when you started to do the postgraduate study. How was that experience with, and I know you spoke about family networks and the difficult times. Could you share a little bit more about that around, how was that first experience with the two children and, trying to study? What were some of the things that you had to go through, and what else? What were the good things and the challenging things as well?
Yeah, I keep saying to myself, just going through that experience, I don't think I'll ever experience anything quite as tough or even tougher than that. Sometimes I think this, because when we remember, I told you when I arrived, it was me and my two sons. My husband was not with us during that time. Because he couldn't travel with us the time that we came. So it was me and those two little children. So it was difficult, because it was coming to a place where I really didn't have any contacts, other than the two people that had been told were also doing their postgraduate studies in in New Zealand as well. One was actually in Palmerston North, the other one was in Auckland, but on the other side of Auckland at a different institution. So I didn't really get to see her, as often as was expected. But the support was amazing. So there was this guy who was the student advisor, student support, and all of that. So he organized that I would be picked from the airport, be taken to our place for the night. That time we're booked in an accommodation for 2 nights before, we moved to an actual house. So I had to look for a house within 2, 3 days, I think, somewhere near the college, because I needed to find accommodation near the university campus so that I would be able to juggle, dropping off children at daycare and then also going to school. Because that time, my husband wasn't here. So it was quite amazing because so this support person was called Brian. I'll just say his name. He sort of organized everything. So the day that I told him that we have found a house, he just said, "Give me the address," and I did. And he brought me everything.
Oh, wow.
Everything from, I don't know, from the couches to the beds to the cooking utensils to the baby's clothes to everything. So I think I really didn't get that stressful, "Oh my goodness, where do I get this? Where do I get that?" Like, we're set up to settle in well. So the first week, the children were in the university kindergarten because that was the nearest, but then it was also very expensive. So I really needed to move them, to a cheaper daycare. So with the older one, because he was just 4, he could go to a kindergarten and he would be using those 20 hours or something like that. For the younger one, the first time he was in this kindergarten, because he was a baby, they were put in trays, like baskets that were looking like trays, and there were so many babies in that place, and some of the babies were really sick. And I was like, "Oh my goodness, will my baby survive in this place?" And also because he's even now, he's not a fussy child. So if you leave him, you leave him. He doesn't cry. He's just that soft kind of a child. So sometimes he would just be left because he just wouldn't cry. It was just a week, but I think it was a very hard time for my baby. So anyway, I did manage to find somebody from Barnardo's. So this would be the, like child care happening, in a house setting. This lady was amazing. I just thought, angels just come, angels are just sent to us from places. So she said to me, "Oh, because you don't have a car." That time we hadn't bought a car. And remember, this is the second week. And I found this lady, and she was like, "Oh, because now it's winter and you need to be going to school and all of those things. I will come and pick the children in the morning. Just prepare them. I pick the children in the morning." So she would pick the children in the morning, drop the oldest at the kindy, and then take the baby. And then I would go to school and then come back home. And then she would, so on my way home, I would pick the oldest from kindy, and then she would bring the baby later on. If I was going to have long days at uni, she would pick the older son, keep the boy children, and then bring them over to me, when I would be home. And I think that happened for, we came in July, August, September, until my husband came in October. And I was like, "Oh my goodness, this is just so warm." I didn't expect that. I didn't expect anybody could just, take your children and they don't even know you and they would support you that way. It was really challenging in not having family, the people I know, the people, I'm used to. But then I also had a new family, just coming out of nowhere, if I could say that. I don't know. I think that answers some of those experiences. There was a lot happening at that time, but I think that is what I remember very much.
No, I think that is such a good, it's such a good experience to have that, people who go out of their way to actually support when new immigrants come into the country. And it's good that you find you had some support with, a 9-month-old. Obviously it does, obviously it was, it would be hard until your husband came. So
It's nice to hear, these positive experiences and stories about how, extended friends or student advisor or whoever, they come in and help you and make your experience so worthwhile. And I guess that was that the reason you came back to New Zealand?
Not exactly, because there were also quite a few bitter experiences anyway. But I think coming back to it was really familiarity, and also because I knew my supervisors. I knew where I was going, in terms of, going to school, and we know where we're going to be putting the children. But again, coming back the second time, I didn't have as much support as the first time. So with the first time, it was so I had been awarded this scholarship. So could have had been why I had all of that support, or also because I was coming in for the first time, could have had been why I had that support. So coming in the second time, I wasn't on a scholarship. Even when I did request for support, like transport from the uni, from the airport and all of that, I was informed that that is only available for people coming for the first time, something like this. So already it was, I think already it was different. Plus, also we're talking about 2012 to 2019. That's about 7 years later. A lot of things would have changed as well in terms of policies, in terms of, some of those funding things. But again, like I'm saying that the first time I was an international student on a scholarship, the other time I'm coming, of course, as an so coming as a PhD student, you're sort of a domestic student. So I think there's the type of care that you receive, that I received, during those two times were completely different. I think it was so much better because I knew how to find my way because I already had some experience. Otherwise, if it was coming for the first time and I didn't get that support that I got in 2012, it was going to be way worse. It was going to be a very very difficult time for me. But again, the first time when I came, oftentimes I would only be the black person, the only black person in the lecture theater. So we'd have these big classes and big lecture theaters, and oftentimes, not oftentimes, always, I was the only black person in class. But then coming back 7 years later, I'm walking even through the uni, every second or third day you bump into a black person, and I'm like, oh my goodness, there's so many of us now. So yeah, that was different too. Just getting to see, the more cosmopolitan, Auckland, the more diverse people just walking around. So that was great too.
And you did mention about the experiences, some of the bad experiences as well, or the challenging ones. If you're happy to share those, I would invite you to share one or two of those, if that's all right.
I think all of them were racist. Some not as explicit, but it was all like underpinned by racism. I'll give an experience, like an example of looking for like supervisors to do my master's. So my first year was a taught paper, and then the was a taught year, and then the second year would be like the research, like full year of research. So one of the things was either you'd go and do the research back home. I think most of my colleagues, most of the other scholarship people that had come were going to do their research back home. But then because of my situation, having two young children, it wasn't going to be convenient for me to go back home and come back again, to go back home, do field work, and then travel back here again with young children and all of that. It wasn't going to work for me. So I ended up having to do my research here. So in doing that as well, I needed to look for supervisors. And one of the things was looking for supervisors. I think my then supervisors were quick to arrange a meeting with me, because the assumption was I could be Maori because of my last name, when in actual fact I'm not.
Oh.
So you can actually see the reaction when people are looking, when someone is walking down the stairs and they're looking for you, to discover that you're not exactly what they were expecting. Even now, I think a few times they did talk about it to say, you know, that was the sort of their expectation, but then didn't think the same. Didn't think that this was who they were going to be meeting. So that would then relate to my husband's experience, because he has an indigenous name. Like, he's got a name that's not English. He really, really did struggle to get a job. So now I just keep believing it was because of his name. A person with an IT background with all of this experience, but wouldn't get a job. He ended up getting a job because I'd gone. So I'd been applying for jobs when I was doing my master's, like looking for part-time work, but I never got it until I walked into a McDonald's, and I just got the, and lucky enough, the manager was there, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm just looking for part-time work. And she was asking me, oh, so what do you do? And I was like, oh, I'm a student, and so forth. So this was a McDonald's that was very near to my uni campus. And then I tell her all my stuff, and she's like, oh yeah, okay, we can give you 20 hours a week. And then she goes, do you have a husband? And I said, yes. And she was like, what is he doing? And I said, he's actually looking for a job as well. And then she was like, oh, we're looking for somebody who does this, 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 and that. Do you think he would be interested? And I was like, oh, I think so. I'll just like, I can always check with him. But at that point, I knew my husband wasn't really choosy because he had been looking for a job for a while. And so I went, I told him, he was like, yeah, he was keen to do the, like, to do that work. And so he did. So he was working at a different store doing other things, and then I was working at another store nearer to home. And that's how we ended up, both of us being employed, just by, you know, just knowing someone and talking to someone. And I was like, if we hadn't met this person, so again, those angels keep coming. If we hadn't met this person, then we wouldn't have, I don't know what our experience was going to be. So I keep thinking it was because of his name, that he wouldn't get a job, until he had to change his name to sort of shorten it to, you know, sound English and all of that. But coming back the second time, he was like, I'm not going to be doing, if people cannot pronounce my name, they'll need to pronounce it. And he hasn't changed his name. And I think things have been different, because he's been applying for jobs. He didn't really struggle to get his first job when we came back. He's been through different jobs already, which I think is quite different from 7 years. I think when we came 7 years ago, which is almost more than 10 years now. But yeah, very, I think it's a very different New Zealand, I think.
Because getting work, obviously many people have highlighted that as a, particularly many new immigrants have highlighted that as one of the challenges that they face. And it's, I think that is the aspect that many of us struggled with initially, and I struggled with it as well. I did mean,
I think, sorry, just one more. I think
Sure.
maybe it's seeing African people for the first time, or what? Because sometimes I just had that feeling that, you know, people are looking at you like they're seeing you for the first time. I remember that first night, that, you know, a few minutes after midnight when I arrived, I was carrying my baby on the back, as we do. We carry our babies on the back. That's what we do. But then people were looking at me like I'm crazy. I remember somebody saying that, you know, it's something will happen to my baby's back. But that's how we're strong, right? That's how we've been molded, by the way that, you know, you're strapped to your mother's back, and then, you know, you move with your mother's spinal cord, and that's how we're strengthened. We've been doing that for generations, but somebody told me that that will damage my child. You know, I should get a pram or a baby, whatever carrying thing. And I was like, oh my goodness. You know, that time I just was like, I mean, what does this even mean? But yeah, again, it's that perhaps that lake of knowing, or, you know, just even having an idea of, you know, how how different people do life, how different people even raise their children. I don't know. I don't have babies at this point, but I don't know what people now think about, carrying babies on the back. I do see people carrying babies in carriers, like on the front, sometimes on the side. You carry your baby in a way that you feel is comfortable for you and is comfortable for the baby. But anyway.
You've actually touched on a very important point, Rachel, about other people knowing how different people do life. I think that is one of the key things that we are hoping to achieve through this podcast. It's one of the things that, there are different people who think differently and different people who come from different parts in the globe have different traditions. And you mentioned about, carrying your baby on your back, and that's how you've been doing it for generations. So the idea of traditions, and that's kind of a segue into my next set of questions around traditions. How do you hold on to those traditions? What are the traditions that you've held on to with your children?
Very difficult to keep things going, especially when we're in a society that we whatever values or the values that we're trying to instill are not like the influence is not as strong because it's just coming from one place, which would be the parents. Growing up back home, the values would more or less be the same, and you'd have different people instilling the same. So you know that even if the children are not with you at home, the teacher would be doing something that's almost similar to what you're sort of believing in, or molding the children in a way that you sort of agree with in a way, if it's the respect, if it's the way that you engage with the elders, if it's the way that you do whatever you do, you'd know that those values are being reinforced. Even if the children are not with you, they've gone to their grandmother's place, for instance. You know the same values are being instilled. So now being in New Zealand, again, with not so many social networks, where you do have the connections, usually it's just getting together for a lunch and then you go off or whatever. So the children really don't have, I don't know, that well-rounded support or that well-rounded network or value, like a network that shares the same value system. It's not there. So that's the most difficult. What values are we trying to instill in our children? Are the same values that we were taught, the same values that were instilled in us? So it's just reinforcing the same. Trying to reinforce the language as much as you can tell that slowly somehow the language is going, but then again it's continuing to speak the language, continuing to do the devotions, continuing to do the prayers and all of those things that we were raised to do. But then it's very challenging in this setting where sometimes even the children question, but why are we doing this? Or children will have questions for you, but sometimes you don't have a response. Sometimes if I was going to ask, I remember also just asking my mom very difficult questions, but then she would just call my auntie or somebody else, and you just talk to somebody and they answer you and that's it. But now it's very difficult because now even if the children talk to their grandparents or things like that, these are very completely different settings, very completely different contexts. Where even I feel for my children because I think they're in a space where perhaps they could even be, caught in a level of confusion themselves, in terms of the values that they see at home and maybe everything else that's happening, around the world. So yes, it's trying as much as we can to instill those values, to just sort of ground the children in our knowingness and in our being. It's quite challenging.
And you did mention about, the support groups and the network. So, with the support or the community groups that you connect out with, what
Mm.
does that network reinforce for you and for your children? Like, is it more about traditions, or is it just like we are not here alone?
Mm.
What does that reinforce?
I think it reinforces just knowing that you're not alone. So just knowing that there are people that you can call on if you do need support. But in terms of that reinforcing values, it's not always the case because of that, like I mentioned, that the contact time is not much. The getting together is not always. It's maybe once every, I don't know, so many times when people are available. And for these children, they're getting together as well once in a while. For example, we grew up and we would just be, playing football outside. And, like every other child in that street would be with you and you're playing, and that is not here, So when these children get together on wherever, how many months, once in how many months, and then they are sort of starting to build that relationship again. They don't get to that point where they get to play and do all these wild things, because they don't have that time to really build the relationships. I don't know if that's making sense at all, but yeah, the community here is reinforcing that, you're not alone. There's we are all here. If you're needing help, there are people here with you. But then sometimes the support doesn't come in the places that you're looking for. Sometimes the support or the relationships are not as enhanced, as they would have had been had we been back home, where I guess, connections would be more, where life wouldn't be as busy, where you actually do take time to visit each other because you do have that support. You have somebody to help you with the children. You have somewhere to send the children so that you could go somewhere and actually, engage with other people. But here, it's just the 9 to 5. And then when you get the time to be free is when you clean the house. If you ever clean the house. But that's what I'm saying, that I think it's just so busy. It's just there are a lot of things that go in the way of building, some of those very enhanced relationships that we know of.
Yeah, no, I think you've mentioned about some of the most important points in there around the value systems and how the influences are reinforced in the home countries that we come from, or are, the countries that we have, and the support networks, and how, there's a different intricate setup, isn't it? Because we've now moved across the world and we can't move our entire families here. So we are just trying to make do with what we have and trying to find support, is what I'm hearing from you, Rachel. So I guess the next question then would be, if someone were to ask you, describe life in New Zealand, what would you say?
I think life is really good. Life is really good in New Zealand, but then also, I think it's also knowing that it doesn't come on a silver platter. Like somebody is to expect to really work or to really put in the yards, to have a comfortable life. I would tell somebody that if they're looking for a comfortable life, one that is maybe similar to whatever they were having, back home, if they had a, really nice job and had all of this, a very big house and, cars and all of those things, just to be mentally prepared that if they decide to move to New Zealand, they are more or less starting afresh. So it doesn't matter if you have the money. It doesn't matter if you have the resources to just come and establish yourself just like that. it's all starting afresh in one way or the other. Financially, you could be okay, but socially, you're just building everything from the ground up. So I think what I'll just tell somebody is, so life is good, so many opportunities. I think it's a matter of being open to some of those opportunities, being open to, experiences or that possibility that the life that they were living or the life that they are living now before migrating or before coming to New Zealand might not be the life that they'll find. So people should just have that open mind to just say whatever that when you do move, you're just still going to start from building yourself from the ground up. Even if it's coming to work in the same sector, it's still building yourself up from the grassroots because it's, starting to adjust to a new context, to a new environment, to new systems, and then you start to grow from there. If it's going to school, then it's again starting with a new curriculum, a new way of learning, a new way of examinations and assessments and all of those things. So it's for somebody to be prepared to start again, to start working again, building whatever it is that they already have built. But it is a beautiful place. It's a very peaceful place, but yeah. Depending on where you're coming from, it's a very, very far place.
I like that. It's a very far place. Rachel, I think you've touched on something very important here, which I just wanted to kind of, again, sort of like a little bit of a discussion on, which is, you said you're building yourself up, and the bit that I really wanted to focus on was the social bit around the fact that when you do come here, those social relationships aren't there. And that is one of the areas, again, the social element. And you're in nutrition and you're in public health. And I'm sure you've got a little bit more insight into how the social impacts the emotional well-being of a person. Can you share a little bit about what you know in this space?
Yeah, I think social is really huge because I think it speaks to everything about our being. So how does it impact us? I think it impacts us in so many ways. So for example, when I was saying that you're sort of building yourself up, so it's getting to know who's my neighbor, like who stays next door, is it somebody that I can talk to? Is it somebody that I can go and, ask them to watch my children if, I need to run to the shops or if I'm having an issue, is that somebody that I could, be calling on? So that is the building up. Who are my children's friends? When they're going to school, if they're walking to school, are they going to be walking with somebody else? Those are some of the connections that we're talking about. But in terms of how does social, influence our well-being, I think it's really strong in the sense that, just having that sense of belongingness or just having that sense of, like I feel like I belong to this place. I feel like I'm accepted in this place. All of those things come from that space where, you're socially well, where you know that, I'm well, I have those social support networks, I have roots in this place, I feel included in this place. My self-esteem is boosted. I am happy in this place. But what we do find with most of us as migrants is that, we lack that sense of belonging, and not having that sense of belonging often impacts on, you feel isolated. You sometimes just keep to yourself. Loneliness comes in, and with those things comes depression and all of those mental health issues as well. Sometimes anxiety as well would knock in because now you're like, oh, I don't feel like I belong in this place. Even going to a community event becomes a very difficult thing. because you feel you do not belong, because you feel you have been excluded, because you feel you have not been accepted. The same thing would be even in a workplace. If you feel that you're not being accepted or appreciated for the work you do, for the skills that you bring, that workplace becomes a very, I don't know, challenging place to be, becomes a very harmful place to be as well. I think our social well-being is the biggest. I think it does have an impact on some of those things that we end up then doing to give ourselves peace, whether it's, I don't know, doing drugs or turning to alcohol or, doing all of those other harmful habits or harmful behaviors because we want to give ourselves that feeling of calm or that feeling of to sort of calm ourselves down. I think the social is really big because if you're going to be going to work and then just being productive or going to school, getting an education, being able to really advance in all of those spaces, I think it only happens if your social well-being is okay. At least that's my feeling. If you're stable socially, then economically you will be stable as well because you know that you have those networks, you know that you're able to pursue different things and attain that economic or that financial goal that you're looking at. Poverty and discrimination and all of those things do impact on our social well-being as well. If you're being discriminated against at work, it does carry its own risks. It's stressful, and just carrying that stress by itself has an impact on our on a person's health. You feel you don't belong, you feel your efforts are not being appreciated, you feel that your children are being bullied, or they actually, children are going also through a lot, they're carrying their own baggage. So we're all carrying those big bags of social unwellness. And that's a disaster in itself. Like that's a ticking time bomb in all aspects. So whatever people are carrying from their work, from their school, from wherever, people bring those things home. Like now I'm working on a family violence and a sexual violence project in migrant communities. And those are the things that are causing, some of these issues that that families are experiencing because people have come from faraway lands to come to a place where they don't feel belong. They belong. They don't feel they are accepted. And then all of those stresses that I've been mentioning pile up, and all of those things happen. And then now you start having, violence happening within families. So yeah. Winded response there, but then yes. I think social wellness is a huge thing. Is a really, really huge thing that. I don't know where we can start to even, like really dissect it.
And I think that is so important that we have this discussion today about highlighting the impact of social wellness, because it's like an iceberg, isn't it? When you were talking about it, Rachel, that's what I was thinking, that at an iceberg, there's the visible bit, which is what, you don't have enough social contacts, you don't have even enough people to call into or rely on, you don't feel like, you've got all of these parts that are on the tip of the iceberg, but then underneath, this is where it is impacting people who do not have these social connections, is around that sense of belonging that you spoke about and the acceptance. And then feeling around, and those feelings around self-esteem that you mentioned, which then lead to behaviors which are going to have long-term impacts on communities. And I think you've picked up a very important project that you're talking about in terms of talking about family violence and sexual violence in migrant communities, because that is an area that is often not spoken about. No, and then you can see the link and how it translates into that social wellness, because basically when we shift across countries, we are pretty much bankrupt socially, aren't we?
Like broke. Like seriously broke. But then again, I think there are ways, to have that, that bankruptcy or whatever be sort of fixed or be reinstated. Because even in those community, like just coming into this place and starting to build, I think it's just having that, I don't know, just knowing that even in that bankruptcy or in that lake of social networks, you can still build it up. You can still, engage with community. You can still start, talking to different, like it's not everybody who would want to talk to you, but then it's talking to the people who you see are also interested in you, building those relationships, starting to volunteer where possible, sometimes just, even if you don't have any money, just helping somebody improves your own happiness. Somebody even just asks you, what, because there are some people who perhaps cannot speak English or something like this, and even you're in a supermarket and they ask you, what is this product for? Like, what do you use this for? And you just try to explain the, what is this? That by itself is helping somebody else, and it makes you feel better as well. So as much as your social bank is in the negative, you do feel better, actively just being, finding yourself in places where people are. I think the good thing is that, there are so many things, like events are always happening in places, like, or even just going outside and just being out and about, just bumping into, people you don't know. You're just taking a walk, or you're just outside. You're just, all of those things make somebody feel better. I think the issues come when we start to sort of overthink about our situations, really think about, oh my goodness, this is what they've done to me at work, and this is what has happened, and this has happened, and then you keep on hanging on to those things. I think this is when those cycles of unhealthy being starts happening, right? But then I think it's also understanding that this is like it's that is the circle of life. Like things will not always go right. Even if you have where you back home, you'd always be having issues at work, you could always be having issues with the neighbor, all of these things could happen. But then I think it's just finding that place or finding that mindset, that, I've made this decision to come into this place, and whatever's gonna happen, I'm just gonna push forward. You're down today, but you can't be down forever. Just be down today. Yes, it's hurtful, something's happened to you, but then pick yourself up, and then, tomorrow is another day. And especially for us as parents, our children will also be expecting us to be there for them as well. So now I think this is where that cycle of stress and its impact then starts catching up with the children, and then, issues start happening, like the example of the violence that's happening and all of those things, because we haven't been able to, I don't know, to sort of moderate ourselves, to sort of bring ourselves back to that point. And one other thing that I also wanted to talk about is, for most of us as migrants of color, I think we also do experience quite a lot of, I don't know, difficult situations because of the many, many social identities that we carry. Because of that intersectionality of all of those factors. So for example, just being black, carries its own set of discrimination and stereotypes and all of those things. Being a woman, it amplifies, some of those things. So what you find now is that we, because of all of these attributes that we carry as people, we also experience a lot of challenges. But then again, it's coming to that place where, as difficult as it is, pulling ourselves back up, and just, taking a day as it comes. And yeah, brighter days will come, but then it's a challenging, really, really challenging journey, I would say.
Yeah, I think you've touched on some important things here again, Rachel, is around the stereotypes and the intersectionality that impacts our well-being here in when we migrate to different countries. And I guess the next question, which is what I have wanted to ask you, was so with all of these, and you know, you've highlighted the impact or the importance of us having resilience because we've got a family here as well. Some of us have got children that we are responsible for. So all of these, you know, if we lack that sense of belonging, how is that going to impact the future generations of migrants? What does that, well, I don't know if you know the answer to it, but I guess we are just exploring.
I guess this is where some of those issues that we hear about, intergenerational trauma coming. Like we read about, the impacts of the experiences, that, some of our ancestors have gone through, that are impacting, even some of these diseases that we carry. There are some of these conditions that are like, oh yeah, no, it runs in the family and all of those things. Some of these things are because of the suffering and the stresses that, some of our ancestors have gone through. So in terms of impact on future generations, I think it's just that lack of social wellness, or that lack of belongingness and its impact, and all of those things that it causes, will actually, I think, can be carried through generations. Because now what you're going to be having is, I don't know, I think a level of stress that goes through generations, a level of, if it's the violence that is taken through generations, if it's a level of low self-esteem that is taken through the generations, because even our children and will see us and they'll be like, oh yeah, so maybe this is who we are as a people, and then they just have that low esteem, and their children carry the same, and then their children's children, carry the same. So I think it does have an impact on future generations. I think I don't know. I think it does, and I think it does have, its health impacts as well. Like I was saying, that the way that you have diseases that are called, oh yeah, no, it just runs in the family. Oh yeah, no, even the grandmother and the great grandmother and whoever also just had the same. Which with some of these things, I think if it continues happening, sometimes I think it'll end up just getting even into your genetics or something like this, that it continues on being carried. I can't speak about any research. I've read about it, like just quick read about it quickly, but I know that there is that link somewhere that maybe we could explore in another conversation.
Yeah, totally, totally. I think that is one of the things that you've touched on a very important point here. I feel throughout the conversation today, the importance of social wellness for immigrants who come. So I think we have kind of reached to the tail end of our conversation today, and I cannot leave you without asking one very specific question around, is New Zealand home? And if it is or if it isn't, what does that feeling of home mean?
Ha. Big one. I think it depends on what day of the week it is. But yeah, I think for now, I would say yes, New Zealand is home, because this is where I am. This is where my husband and my children are. So we have this physical space where we do call our home, and because we are together, that is where our home is. We feel safe. We are comfortable, I think, most times. And despite the other things, like the other negative factors or negative, influences that perhaps would have spoken about, I think I'd say yes, New Zealand is home. But again, when we think about where our roots are, where our heritage is, I don't know, where you know, where community is. Like, we do have community in New Zealand, but it's a very different one. Because every time when you, for me, I think this, my husband keeps saying, you know, home is where the heart is, and we, which is right. So I think it's on any given day in our physical, in our, you know, in our, the relationships that we have, even our spiritual connection, we do have it in this place, right? And then this becomes home for us. But then people would also say, you know, home is not a feeling. I mean, home is not a place, it's a feeling. So I think going through some of those situations that are challenging, where you're like, oh my goodness, what is going on? You know, and you're like, oh, if I was home, you know, because that is where your feeling is taking you. But then for me, I just think it's you carry home. Like, I carry home with me. So it's a way I feel I'm happy, where I feel the love, where I feel my, in this present, it's where my husband and my children are, you know, where I'm feeling that I'm thriving, you know, I'm feeling that, you know, all of these good things, for me, it's the good things are happening more than the not so good things. It's where my home is. So yes, as difficult as it is, yes, your Aotearoa is home, but then I also do have another home. So
Yeah, no, and you're not the first one to say that. That's beautiful. And I liked how you said home is what I carry, which is beautiful. So thank you very much, Rachel.
You're most welcome, Hafsa.
Thanks for joining us on In Transit. If today's story moved you, taught you something new, or simply made you feel seen, we'd love for you to share this episode with someone else. Also, don't forget to tune in to Plains Media for the next episode. Until next time, remember, your story matters.